In the early decades of the 21st century, an observant spectator might perceive the striking ambiguity that haunts the self-image of late modern humanity in the Western Hemisphere. The rapidly accelerating progress of the scientific penetration of the natural world and the ensuing technological domination of the whole planet seem to have advanced humanity into a quasi-divine position, into a collective demiurge. Sovereignty, once upon a time an exclusive attribute of divinity, seems now to fall to humanity collectively, and in rather far-reaching specific ways to each individual human subject. In the affluent parts of the Western Hemisphere, subjective sovereignty is exercised by way of the unfettered rule of one's will over ideally everything exterior to one's will, from myriads of consumer goods to varyingly branded identities, and last but not least, ideological and religious affiliations. The precious and tenaciously defended privilege of subjective sovereignty is, of course, choice. The scope of choice is seen as directly proportional to the degree of subjective sovereignty. An increase in the former indicates an increase in the latter. However, the interpretation of reality that the natural sciences communicate to the public presents a jarringly different picture, a picture that puts into question the very possibility of subjective sovereignty. The human mind is understood as an epiphenomenon of the brain's neurological processes. Human choices are predicted with statistical precision and are masked as ultimately driven by nothing other than the interests of the selfish gene. According to the naturalist savants of the most advanced life sciences, humans are nothing but highly sophisticated primates that will eventually be transparent without remainder to the scientific gaze and therefore open to comprehensive governance by way of the most advanced psychological and technological means of manipulation. Thus, the modern subject, the product of the anthropocentric turn, vacillates between two competing self-images. On the one side, we find the Gnostic angelism of the putatively disembodied sovereign self that may submit to its will an absolutely malleable and fluid exteriority. And on the other side, we find the materialist animalism of a super primate that is the accidental product of the intricate interplay between random genetic mutation and specific ecological niche preferment. The extremes touch each other insofar as transhumanism, an outgrowth of the fantasies of the sovereign self, and post-humanism, the reductive understanding of the human being as super primate, coincide in their de facto erasure of the embodied rational being, the animal rationale. As always, so also in our contemporary context, deeply shaped by the utopian pretenses of transhumanism and posthumanism, sovereignty has two aspects. The sovereign agent and the objects upon which sovereignty is exercised. The interminable struggle in late modern technologically advanced, economically consumer capitalist, and politically putatively liberal societies of the Western Hemisphere is to avoid at all costs being subjected to and thereby objectified by the sovereignty of others, and simultaneously to maximize one's possibilities of exercising subjective sovereignty. In our robustly secular and deeply skeptical Western societies, subjective sovereignty is the one transcendence the modern subject remains certain of, because it is self-produced. This particular form of transcendence is a decidedly immanent transcendence. Its outer horizon is death. For death defies all strategies of maintaining or increasing subjective sovereignty, albeit with one significant exception, namely the unique strategy of folding death into the last act of one's own subjective sovereignty, by sovereignly determining the terminus of oneself and the subsequent annihilation of one's body. Sovereign self-destruction unmasks the dead end into which the anthropocentric turn ultimately leads. The self-image of subjective sovereignty can be consistently maintained to the very end only if it is sealed by an act of sovereign self-destruction. It is this ironic consequence that betrays the profound pretension and falsehood of this self-image. What might be the cure from this pervasive but profoundly false self-image? I would submit, in all due modesty, that the only lasting cure will be nothing short of undoing the anthropocentric turn itself. Quite obviously, the world cannot be saved in the course of one academic sabbatical, let alone the anthropocentric turn undone in a single late afternoon lecture. But a first modest step in this direction might consist in this: to consider the most fundamental and radical alternative to anthropocentrism, an alternative, nota bene, that is not simply the contradictory to subjective sovereignty, that is, some imagined competitive sovereign of an other, in capital letters, as most moderns would misunderstand divine sovereignty, namely as an alternative sovereignty that would annihilate or at least curtail subjective sovereignty, a competitive sovereignty that in the service of protecting subjective sovereignty must be placated, ignored, or simply declared non-existent. Such a cure would not get at all to the root of the problem, but only intensify the anthropocentric turn. Rather, getting to the root of the problem would mean to undertake the labor of recovering the primordial reality of the transcendent good and its non-competitive sovereignty. This recovery would afford once again direct access to an objective moral reality in the light of which we can begin to understand the deeply problematic nature of the anthropocentric turn. This program of recovery forms an important part of the Thomist engagement of modernity. At the heart of this program stands the comprehensive retrieval of the metaphysics of being, which in its full depth is necessarily a metaphysics of creation. It rests on the fundamental Thomistic principle, creare est dare esse, to create is to give existence. This principle marks the crucial ontotheological difference between the transcendent creative source of all existence, the subsistent act of being on the one hand, and on the other hand the participated act of being, the dare esse, the term of which is the datum, the gift of the contingent existence of discrete beings. Nothing less than such a recovery will reach deep enough in order to eradicate the bitter roots from which the anthropocentric turn arises. The Thomistic metaphysics of creation entails three fundamental premises. Premises I cannot develop, let alone defend, but only name, and in the following steps suppose as true, because I intend to focus on one, albeit crucial, consequence of these premises, the primordial conscience. It is the reality of the primordial conscience, I submit, that allows us best to confront the problem of subjective sovereignty and in principle already to overcome it. But first, the three fundamental premises entailed in the metaphysics of creation. First, the ontological premise. Deus omnium entium est mensura. God is the measure of all things. Through the creative knowledge of God, all real things are what they are. Differently put, all created things have their preform, their model, in the intellect of God. The divine knowledge is their exterior formal cause. Aquinas puts it thus in De Veritate. Created things from which our intellect receives knowledge give the measure to our intellect. But they have received their measure from the divine intellect, in which all created things are as all objects of art are in the mind of the artist. Thus the divine intellect gives the measure and does not receive the measure. But created things both give and receive the measure. But our intellect, in regard to natural objects, is receptive of the measure and does not give the measure. Our intellects give the measure only in regard to artifacts. Unquote. In the last sentence, Aquinas refers to the realm of technae and ars, technique and art, the vast realm of human creative ingenuity. But the intellect's ability to give the measure depends on the antecedent reception of the measure by the intellect. Aquinas states in the Summa, "The intellect receives its measure from objects. That is, human knowledge is true not of itself, but it is true because and insofar as it conforms to reality." Unquote. Thus, the second premise, the epistemological premise, follows directly from the ontological premise. Parche Kantian critical realism and Husserlian transcendental phenomenology. Human cognition attains the truth of real things. In the order of being, measure is received as substantial form by the extant thing, by way of the original gift of being. In the order of knowledge, measure is received as intentional form by the intellect, from the extant thing, by way of the senses. According to Thomas, the measure that constitutes the thing, the substantial form, and the measure that the object communicates to the intellect, the intentional form, are identical, but subsist in different ways. From the epistemological premise follows the third premise, which pertains to the order of action. Here is one of Aquinas's many formulations of this principle. Quote, "The will is not the first norm. It is guided by knowledge." This is again from De Veritate on Truth. Human willing and acting are determined by knowledge. The intellect's relation to reality antecedes the will's relation to it. As the rational appetite, the will depends on the prior deliveries of the intellect. The intellect's proper object is being, and the intellect's proper end is truth. Affirming the primacy of the intellect over the will, Aquinas states that, quote, "The good, as truth, is related more primarily to knowledge than it is related as good to the will." Unquote. The human good is therefore not what the will sovereignly determines it to be. Rather, the human good is that which is first and foremost in accord with reality. But what is reality? Reality is one of those concepts that belong to the very bedrock of Aquinas' metaphysics. For Aquinas, reality means primarily two things expressed by the two Latin words realis and actualis, the one derived from the Latin res, thing, and the other from actus, action. Res, thing, signifies everything that is presented to our sense perception or our intellectual cognition. It signifies what has being independently of our thinking. Actualitas, on the other hand, signifies the opposite to whatever is merely potential. Reality in the sense of actualitas, actuality, means realized potentiality. And to be good means to be directed towards realization. Aquinas states, "Every being is perfect insofar as it is realized, and imperfection lies in this, that its potentiality is not realized." Unquote. And absolute actualitas, without any remaining potency whatsoever, the ens actualissimum, the most actualized of all beings, is the sovereign good, is God. But now we reach point number 3 on your handout, the eternal and the natural law. According to the ontological constitution of participated being, each being is first and foremost directed to its own perfection. to the full actualization of its nature. Simultaneously, by the self-same actualization of its nature, every being is directed to the twofold good of the universe. The order among the parts and the ordering of the whole universe to God. Aquinas holds it that to be an entailment of the suffering good, God, that God in all eternity, by an act of the divine will, intends the end of a perfect universe as the true manifestation of his suffering goodness. No single being, however, is able perfectly to manifest this surpassing goodness. And therefore, God created an abundance of diverse beings with a plethora of different perfections. And thereby the universe as a whole more perfectly manifests and participates in God's goodness. However, beings are more like God, Thomas argues, when they act and cause being. For this very reason, God created all things in a state of potency to their particular type of action. When each being performs its particular type of action, it contributes to the perfection of the universe. And because God creates and guides creatures to their proper perfection in light of the same end, the perfection of the whole, each being acts in accord with its particular mode of participation in the act of being, which is its substantial form, namely its primary perfection, Thomas says. Through these acts, which are its secondary perfection, next to the primary perfection, the substantial form, each being reaches its specific end. These secondary perfections are the way each being participates in what Thomas calls the eternal law, the ratio by way of which God governs the universe. God's ratio, the eternal law, has imprinted upon all beings natural inclinations to their proper natural ends. And precisely by following their natural inclinations, all beings pursue their own perfection and contribute thereby to the perfection of the whole universe. That's the big picture. Now, rational beings, Thomas argues, participate in this ratio in a unique way, a way proper to their intellect. In analogy to the natural law, Aquinas calls this natural cognitive participation of rational beings in the eternal law, natural law. In virtue of the natural law, rational beings are partakers of a share of providence, Thomas says, by being both provident for themselves and for others. This participation occurs by way of the natural inclination of practical reason to the proper act and end of the rational being. Quote, on the part of practical reason, the human being has a natural participation of the eternal law according to certain general principles. Aquinas calls this natural participation of the eternal law by the human being synderesis, which in a nutshell denotes the primordial conscience. What is this primordial conscience? Conscience, synderesis. Aquinas distinguishes two aspects of the human intellect, and we need to understand it in this analogy of those two aspects to each other. Aquinas distinguishes two aspects of the human intellect, speculative reason and practical reason. The end of each is truth. For speculative reason, truth in the theoretical order. For practical reason, truth in the order of agency. Theoretical and practical reason are only able to pursue and achieve their end, truth, Thomas argues, in virtue of certain fundamental principles that reside in the intellect as innate habits or dispositions. The innate habit of speculative reason contains the first principles of abstract reason. The innate habit of practical reason contains the first principles of action. The principle of non-contradiction is based upon the concept of being. which is the proper object of the speculative reason. And the first principle and the first precept of synderesis is based upon the concept of the good, which is the proper object of practical reason. Let us look now more closely at the primordial conscience, at synderesis. To repeat once more, synderesis, according to Thomas, is a natural, innate habit of the human mind. Not acquired, comes with us as we are born. We don't acquire it. We can't really lose it either. It's core. It's there. That's what he means by innate habit. In virtue of this unique habit, human beings are enabled and indeed ordered to have, as Thomas formulates it, a primary infallible judgment about the good as the end and meaning of human actions. Unquote. The destination towards such a primary and infallible judgment is possible because this innate natural habit contains the first principle and the first precept of practical reason. The first principle is, quote, good is that which all things seek after. And its first precept is, good is to be done and pursued, and evil is to be avoided. It is important to realize right away that the first precept does not primarily signify an obligation to do the good. That would be our kind of Kantian brainwashing. That's not the case, according to Thomas. Rather, it expresses the attraction of the good. It is this urgency of the truth within the good, within the very attraction of the good, that is at the heart of the innate, that is at the heart of the intimate awareness of duty and obligation. The first precept expresses the inherent attraction of the good as understood good. The natural habit of first principle and first precept enable the rational creature not only to move to some perceived good, but to realize the ratio finis, the character of good, beyond that, simply being moved to it. Because good is the perfection which all beings desire and to which all beings move as their final end, the primal conscience, synderesis, enables the human, qua rational being, to realize the teleology of the good by participating, by way of the natural law, in the eternal good, in the eternal law. And genuine human freedom arises precisely from the rational being's proper rational participation in the eternal law, and is perfected when the rational being acts fully in accord with the eternal law. Incidentally, on the supposition of the fundamental teleological ordering of the universe, the so-called naturalistic fallacy, the allegedly illicit naturalistic or metaphysical transition from is to ought, from the order of being to the moral order, a putative fallacy invented by David Hume and named by G.E. Moore, is a mute concern. For belonging all the way down to the extant teleologically ordered universe, human beings, as all other beings, are teleologically constituted by way of their natural inclinations. As a tendency to its proper end or good, the ought is embedded in the is of every being, and especially in those beings that realize their perfection through the exercise of practical reason. The primordial conscience, synderesis, is not only a formal but a teleological principle interior to practical reason itself. There's one further implication given with the interior teleological constitution of practical reason. Because synderesis, the primordial conscience, is a habitual light, illumination as Thomas can call it, innate habit as an illumination of the mind, it prevents the dictates of conscience from ever becoming heteronymous. For the dictates of conscience are nothing but the concretization, by way of judgment, of those principles and precepts that are constitutive of the teleological ordering of practical reason itself. For this very reason, an objective teleological ethics grounded in the primordial conscience and in the natural inclinations, and I should of course say in the virtues therefore, remains untouched by the false binary of heteronomy versus autonomy, the direct result, I would suggest, of the anthropocentric turn, that binary, that haunts most modern moral philosophy. Turning away from the primordial conscience and with it from the teleological order of reality and embracing instead the negative freedom of sovereign self-determination, the anthropocentric turn and the consequent sovereign subjectivity give rise to a pervasive counterfeit of conscience, the presumptuous authenticity of self-will. This counterfeit is condemned to a never-ending vigilance against the constant threat of a hostile takeover by other sovereign self-wills, be they human others or a supposed divine other misconceived in the false self-image, according to this false self-image of subjective sovereignty. We must now turn to the act of the primordial conscience. Aquinas calls this act conscientia, knowing together. Recall, Aquinas defines the primordial conscience as a natural habit of first principles of action, which are the universal principles of the natural law. This primordial conscience, in the Rhesus, names practical reason as perfected by a completely determined habit. The natural determination of practical reason consists in a primordial perception of the proper good of the human being. But what does all this mean on the operational level? Conscientia signifies the actualization of the natural habit of the first principles of moral truth in two respects. There occurs first a concrete judgment of practical reason to be followed, secondly, by a command of reason that applies this knowledge to action. The judgment of conscientia normally occurs prospectively, that is, antecedent to the execution of a specific exterior act. But it also may occur retrospectively, consequent to the execution or the omission of some specific exterior act. In order to gain a deeper understanding of the objective nature of primordial conscience and its actualization in conscientia, in what we call conscience, we must appreciate how conscientia relates to the principal cardinal virtue, prudence, which Aquinas defines as right practical reason. He calls prudence the following way. He says about prudence, prudence imprints the inward seal of goodness upon all free activity of the human being. Hence, what is prudent and what is good are substantially one and the same. They differ only in their place in the logical succession of realization. For what is good must first have been prudent. What difference does the virtue of prudence make if indeed, as Aquinas claims, synderesis moves prudence, the knowledge of the truth in the practical order, just as the understanding of principles moves science, the knowledge of the demonstrative truth in the theoretical order? To be sure, prudence does make a crucial difference. Among the three acts of the virtue of prudence, to take counsel, to judge, and to command, conscientia comprises the second act, to judge, when this judgment is right and certain, that is, when it is indeed properly formed by the virtue of prudence. But nota bene, conscientia, in and of itself, is not efficacious in choosing and doing the good. Consider the morally weak person. Following Aristotle, Aquinas called such a person incontinent. The incontinent person, quote, knows what he or she ought to do, his or her conscience is all right, but the knowledge of the good is not completed by an effective appetitive disposition to good as good. That is why in the crunch, in choosing, this person goes wrong. While judgments of conscientia are absolutely indispensable for moral goodness, simple conscientia lacks the power of execution. What remains indispensable for efficaciously choosing and doing the good are the two other acts of the virtue of prudence, counsel and command, in concert with the remaining cardinal virtues, justice, fortitude and temperance. At its very best, that is when it is right and certain, the antecedent judgment of conscience is an integral component of the virtue of prudence. Once the habit of prudence has been diminished or completely lost due to contrary acts of imprudence, and the act of counsel prevented by precipitation or by thoughtlessness, the flight from the synderistic indicator of moral truth prepares the indulgence in the counterfeit of conscience, the presumptuous authenticity of self-will. Regarding its own decisions as intrinsically infallible expressions of a sovereign self-determination, the counterfeit forgoes counsel. The decisions the counterfeit posits create the semblance of a true and therefore good conscience, precisely because the counterfeit's decisions are held as infallible. By feigning authenticity, the sovereign self-determination produces a counterfeit that blocks access to the synderistic root of right judgment. But how does this phenomenon, the counterfeit of conscience producing such a simulacrum of the true and therefore good conscience, relate to the phenomenon of the erroneous conscience? Could the counterfeit of conscience not be understood as an instantiation of the erroneous conscience? That this is not the case will become plain when we understand the characteristics of an erroneous conscience. The judgment of conscientia, Thomas Aquinas says, the application of the universal principles of synderesis to a particular case is not infallible. When properly informed by prudence, that is when conformed to right intention according to the principles and precepts of synderesis, and when subjectively certain, the judgment of conscientia is practically true and right. But the agent might suffer from ignorance and might therefore be objectively burdened by an erroneous conscience. Hence, the characteristic deficiency of an erroneous conscience is ignorance. Such ignorance can be voluntary or involuntary, vincible or invincible, according to Thomas. Since the dictate of conscience binds and must be obeyed, a dictate issuing from an objectively erroneous conscience must nevertheless be subjectively obeyed. Aquinas rightly insists upon this point. But does such an insistence not open the door to the authenticity of self-will, the counterfeit of conscience? Consider how Aquinas distinguishes between the objective and the subjective perspective. Quote, conscience is said to bind insofar as one sins if he does not follow his conscience, but not in the sense that he acts correctly if he does follow it. Conscience is not said to bind in the sense that what one does according to such a conscience will be good, but in the sense that in not following it, he will sin. A correct conscience and a false conscience bind in different ways. The correct conscience binds absolutely and for an intrinsic reason. The false binds in a qualified way and for an extrinsic reason. Unquote. The erroneous conscience does indeed bind, not because it is correct, but because the judgment of conscientia is all a person can go by at the moment. Nevertheless, the erroneous conscience can be identified eventually as such because it depends upon the logical priority of the correct conscience, which applies the principles of synderesis rightly. From the agent's perspective, the way to find out whether one has acted from an erroneous conscience or not occurs in light of instruction, counsel, or self-examination by way of a consequent judgment of conscientia, either in the form of moral self-critique that elicits regret and remorse in the case of a formerly erroneous conscience, or in form of a simple retrospective affirmation that one's true and therefore good conscience has indeed also been right. Precisely because of the innate habit of synderesis, the principle and therefore the concrete possibility of self-correction always obtains. We can know better. For this reason, it is the case that while the erroneous conscience indeed binds, it does not automatically excuse, Aquinas explains. If reason or conscience should err voluntarily, either directly or because of negligence, being in error about something one is held to know, then such error does not prevent the will, which is in accord with erring reason or conscience, from being evil. Similarly, supposing error of reason or conscience, which proceeds from a non-excusing ignorance, evil in the will necessarily follows. However, such a person is not perplexed, because he can correct his error, since his ignorance is both vincible and voluntary. Culpable erroneous conscience is caused either by negligence, which makes it indirectly voluntary, or by willful ignorance, which makes it directly voluntary. In his commentary on the senses, the young Aquinas offers a pithy summary of this very complex matter. To follow one's erring conscience means to be unable to avoid sinning, but to act against one's conscience means to directly incur sin. To turn intentionally against the judgment of conscience is always culpable, because it means that one cuts oneself off from the very possibility of following moral truth. To follow one's erring conscience means to do what seems subjectively right, but what is objectively wrong. We have reached a point where we can name the difference between the erroneous conscience and the counterfeit of conscience. First, from the objective perspective afforded by the Thomistic metaphysics of being and the good, and its entailed moral science, the reality of an erroneous conscience presupposes an objective moral order and reliable knowledge of it. For consistent moral subjectivism and the concomitant rule of self-will, on the contrary, an erroneous conscience is an utterly meaningless notion. By positing its own dictates of self-will, the subjectivist counterfeit of conscience is by definition infallible. Because it is the law of its own dictates, there is nothing in light of which the counterfeit of conscience can possibly err. In the wake of the anthropocentric turn, sincerity, authenticity, and being at peace with oneself become the new criteria of a radically subjectivist conception of moral judgment in service of the sovereign self. These new criteria come to replace the rule of ethical truth implemented by the virtue of prudence. Second, from the agent's perspective, the very possibility of an erroneous conscience entails an antecedent and a consequent personal duty. The antecedent duty is to avoid ignorance and imprudence. Formulated positively, the antecedent duty is always to seek counsel, to have one's conscience formed by those one regards as wiser and better informed than oneself, and first and foremost to avail oneself of the instruction by and guidance of those whose specific vocation is to instruct conscience by teaching the secondary precepts of the natural law. The consequent duty is to avoid negligence and indifference by way of a regular examination of conscience, a sincere review of past judgments, and repentance of acts done due to an erroneous conscience. Third, in light of Aquinas' doctrine of conscience, the counterfeit of conscience is objectively a result of willful ignorance, or at least of negligence and thoughtlessness. In the worst case, the counterfeit is an intentional, self-conscious flight from conscience, By positing decisions of the self-will, a person acts in direct opposition to the judgments of a correct conscience. Does this mean that the counterfeit of conscience is able to extinguish synderesis, the primordial voice of conscience? Aquinas addresses this question explicitly. He denies that synderesis can be extinguished in its root through a loss of the innate habit. Quote, "For this light belongs to the nature of the soul, since by reason of this the soul is intellectual." Unquote. But regarding the actualization of this disposition or habit, synderesis can indeed be deflected toward the contrary of synderesis. Whenever, quote, "the force of concupiscence or of another passion so absorbs reason that in choice the universal judgment of synderesis is not applied to the particular act," unquote. It is here that Aquinas points to what we might call the dark secret of the counterfeit of conscience. What looks to the person fleeing primordial conscience like the sovereignly posited decisions of self-determination is indeed the product of a profound self-deception. The flight from primordial conscience actually makes the moral agent subject to the power of the sensual passions and the variegated desires of the will to which they give rise. However, because the primordial conscience cannot be destroyed, but only fled from or suppressed, the counterfeit of conscience must be willfully maintained, directly or more frequently indirectly. For all the decisions the counterfeit sovereignly posits remain exposed to the habitual light that the first principle and the first precept of synderesis shed on the agent's reason. The counterfeit is therefore inherently unable to gain the peace that is characteristic of a conscience that is both subjectively true and therefore good and objectively correct. Where have we arrived? At Aquinas' sobering suggestion that to be good is to do the truth. For good is that which is in accord with reality, a reality whose measure is the first truth, who is the sovereign good. Every human being, qua rational being, has received a natural innate habit that reflects the measure that the rational being received in its rational nature. While the sphere of theoretical thinking is governed by the fundamental principle of non-contradiction, the sphere of practical thinking is governed by synderesis, the first principle of the natural law. In Aquinas' words, quote, "the original direction of all our actions toward the end is necessarily brought about by the natural law," unquote. The whole moral motivation of rational beings depends upon the voice of primordial conscience, the natural, habitual awareness of the precepts of the natural law. From a Thomist perspective, the typically modern crisis of moral motivation, why should I pursue the good? Why should I be moral in the first place, is a direct consequence of the anthropocentric turn and the subsequent flight from the encompassing teleology of which the primordial conscience is an integral part. This flight produces the counterfeit of conscience, the authenticity of self-will that interminably vacillates between three versions of self-justification: moral nihilism, there is neither good nor evil, good and evil are strictly subjective success terms, moral skepticism, human beings are inherently incapable of discerning reliably moral good and evil, and moral sovereignty, I am the creator and arbiter of my own moral code. These accretions of the anthropocentric turn commit those who come under their spell to constant performative self-contradictions in everyday life, because persons who hold these views nevertheless continue to act toward ends that are first perceived as goods. And it is precisely this that makes these actions intelligible in the first place. Intelligible actions, however, are, as Alastair MacIntyre has shown, the basic units of human moral agency. I might actually go back to ends come to be true.
Yeah, I think so.
And these units have an irreducible teleological structure, a structure that, as Aquinas has argued, necessitates a single final end. Hence, modern agents, beholden by the false self-image of subjective sovereignty, de facto display the first principle of practical reason, follow the first precept of the natural law, and for the most part also acknowledge an at least tacit knowledge of some of the secondary precepts of the natural law. As Alastair MacIntyre has pointedly stated in his still eminently relevant study from 1990, Three Rival Versions of Moral Inquiry, quote, "The Thomist discerns in the continuous reappropriation of the deracinated and fragmented moral rules of European modernity, and in the recurring resistance to discarding them, evidence of the work of synderesis, of that fundamental grasp of the primary precepts of the natural law, to which cultural degeneration can partially or temporarily blind us, but which can never be obliterated." Unquote. That is from page 194, if you want to reread it, which I recommend the book highly. In the following conclusion, MacIntyre makes the implicit organizing principle of my reflections explicit. Quote, "So, the Thomist claims to be able to render intelligible the history of both modern morality and modern moral philosophy in a way that is not available to those who themselves inhabit the conceptual framework peculiar to modernity. They cannot hope to understand themselves in the only terms which they and their institutions allow themselves for understanding. And their own theories, the theories of those imprisoned within modernity, can thus provide only ideological rationalizations, the rationalizations of modern deontology, modern consequentialism, and modern contractarianism." Unquote. Modern deontology, consequentialism, and contractarianism are moral theories that emerge in the wake of the anthropocentric turn. As the history of modernity has demonstrated, these moral theories turned out to be utterly unfit to contain the power of subjective sovereignty that the anthropocentric turn unleashed. Aquinas's teleological metaphysics of the good, with its special emphasis on synderesis, natural law, and the virtue of prudence, advances a compelling account why this is the case, and thereby offers a powerful analytic device that allows us accurately to gauge the profoundly problematic implications of the anthropocentric turn for moral theory, and especially for the moral life. Aquinas's realist metaphysics opens up the ontological and epistemological horizon in which the philosophical errancy of the anthropocentric turn comes into full light. What Aquinas's metaphysics of being and the good cannot do, and of course was never meant to do, is to turn us back efficaciously from the perennial existential crisis, a crisis that the anthropocentric turn has only intensified. Even when we do not flee the voice of primordial conscience, but are attentive to it, there remains a pressing question. How can one be good, and therefore do the truth, without first encountering the truth in such a direct and personal way that we find ourselves not only claimed by the truth, but fall in love with its surpassing goodness, such that we become effectively good? Aquinas, of course, holds the faith characteristic of an Orthodox Christian, which is the faith of the Church, namely that the suffering good has become incarnate. Yet with this claim, Aquinas beckons us to ascend from metaphysics to mystagogy, from the philosophy of the suffering good to the elevated science he called sacra doctrina, sacred teaching. This sacred teaching rests on one breathtakingly simple and breathtakingly outlandish axiom. The first truth and the suffering good are at hand in the utter humility and vulnerability of the human nature, the incarnate Logos assumed from among a people God created for that purpose. Here is the ultimate stumbling block for the sovereign self, its pride and despair, and simultaneously the concrete hope to enter a new life in which death has been definitely overcome precisely by the incarnate suffering good. In this new life, the pursuit of subjective sovereignty can be relinquished because the cage of immanent transcendence has been opened from the outside by the suffering good. In the personal encounter with the one who says, "I am the truth," the one who gives his life for his enemies and calls us to become his friends, it becomes obvious. Primordial conscience tells us to be good is to do the truth. This is the fundamental principle that subsists as habitual light in the practical reason and enjoins the first precept of the natural law. But in order to become good in the first place, so that we can effectively do the truth, one must be united with the truth. For the incarnate sovereign good also said, "Without me, you can do nothing." I thank you for your attention.